Today is Friday, April 13th, 2018, at noon, and this is panel 5201, entitled, All the New Ways We'll Search for Extraterrestrial Life. Welcome. My name is Alphonse Kiesling, and I'll be the moderator for this session. I hope that the sight lines are okay, that you will be able to see most of us. If necessary, we might have someone stand. I'm not going to do that for you right now, though. Okay, so on the panel today, we have three, if you're using, as I was, the old booklet, it's a little different from what was presented before. Our panelists include today Dr. Jan Amond, who's professor of earth sciences and biology from the University of Southern California. He was a researches life in subsurface areas, life underground, basically, on Earth, Mars, and in other areas here of life, in extreme environments. It's really interesting. When speaking to Professor Amond, I found out that he goes into all sorts of interesting places, but he's aware that he should not dive and go into caves underwater. So it's really important. A lot of people, he informed me, do not make it out sometimes from those travels. Next, we will have Brian Hennick, who is a professor of in our geological science and also our LASP, in LASP. He also is doing this type of research. He's the director of the Center for Astrobiology, and he finds himself climbing into active volcanoes.
Oh, wow.
And then the last panelist that we have today is Adam Frank, who's a professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester, and a self-proclaimed evangelist of science who is committed to showing us the beauty and power of science. In addition to being a science writer, he is also an on-air commentator for the program All Things Considered. We'll let some of the folk try to find seats. Please, if you could raise your hand to let people know where there's an empty seat next to you so that we can get this going really well. Thank you very much. We may have to do this a few times. Keep your hands up so we can find places for people to find seats. And we'll begin in a few seconds with Professor Amond. Just to let you know, while we're getting the seating arrangement taken care of, in this particular session, we're going to use the note card system. The note card system rather than using the app. So if you are interested in raising a question, please make sure that you raise your hand so that one of the producers or co-producers will be able to bring a note card to you and then you write your question down. Students, we are particularly interested in you indicating when you are in fact a student so that we can identify you because we'll give priority to your particular questions. I'm sorry, not that we're going to ignore anyone, but we just want to make sure that we get the student involved. And with that, I will go ahead and get started with Professor Coffey.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to see so many people in the room. It's almost a full room. That's really, really great. Since this is a session about life, albeit extraterrestrial life, I thought I would start with a few fundamentals about life, about biology, perhaps some basic information that you haven't thought about or haven't heard much about. First point I want to make is that we have exactly one data point on life in the universe, and that is life on Earth. Yes, there is life on Earth. Some might argue there's intelligent life on Earth. We do not have robust scientific evidence for life that is elsewhere. We have indications. We have interest in looking for it. We have signatures that might suggest life, but we do not have robust evidence of life other than life on Earth. Second point I want to make is, will we know it if we see it? It is actually extremely difficult, surprisingly difficult, to define what life is. The BBC recently did a very detailed analysis and determined that scientists have more than 100 definitions of life, many of them wrong. So is it like, I'm afraid to say this, but is it like pornography? Is it one of those things where you know it when you see it? Or are there actually categories or criteria we can use to say if we find these things, then we define such a thing as life. Remember, we're not expecting to see bunny rabbits hopping across the field of view on some camera attached to a rover on Mars. Probably what most of us, certainly people who are focused on our solar system, are looking for are microbial life forms, single-celled structures that have very little structure, and it's very difficult then to say that is definitely life, that is not. The third point I want to make is, what are some of the criteria for life? Remember, our evidence of life is Earth, so we ought to make sure that we're not being too Earth-centric in our definition of life. But it's also the evidence we currently have. So if we totally ignore Earth-centric life, then it's really difficult to know what to look for. And if we're too myopic, then we might miss things that are not Earth-like. For example, does life have to be carbon-based? I'm not going to answer these questions. I'm just throwing them out there for you. Does life have to be water-based? Does it have to be encapsulated? In other words, does it have to be in the form of cells? Does life necessarily have to do metabolism or some kind of conversion of energy? Does it have to have resources going into the life form and waste products coming out of that life form? Is it necessary for life to have information storage? Does it have to be able to grow? Does it have to be able to produce, reproduce? Is evolution, adaptation, or change in some way an absolute requirement for something we would call life? Does it have to have functional activity? Is death a requirement of life? So does life have to meet any, some, most, all, or none of these criteria? That's hotly debated among scientists, and perhaps something you should think about too. I'm going to give you a few examples of what may or may not be life, and I'm not asking you to yell out your answers, but think to yourself, would you classify that as life? A classic one that's often used is viruses. Viruses are not cells. They don't do metabolism. They are inert without a host. But they have DNA, so they have information storage. They replicate, they evolve. Would you not consider that life? Dormant microbes. If you know it's a microbe, then yes, it's life, but oftentimes you'll just see some blob, tiny little thing in a microscope, and dormant microbes can actually be inactive, do absolutely nothing, with no sign of activity for thousands, perhaps millions of years. So how would you know that's life if it's not doing anything? What about a mule? Right? This is an idea that Brian gave to me yesterday. They don't reproduce, right? They don't evolve. But would you consider a mule not to be life, right? So it gets tricky. Crystals. Crystals grow. They convert energy. They change. Fire. A lot of the definitions I threw out there will apply to fire. It's carbon-based. It grows. It can reproduce in the sense that, you know, fire can start in one place and then move to another place. That's a new fire now. It takes in resources, wood, let's say, and gives off waste products, CO2, let's say, right? So a lot of the definitions that I just gave you for life apply to fire, but very few people would consider fire life. Artificial intelligence, computer viruses, the list goes on and on. So, as mentioned in the introduction, I think a lot about extra, sort of extreme life forms. So I thought I'd mention just a few things about the limits of life. If we know what the limits of life are, then we can sort of focus our search for life perhaps a bit better. What is the upper temperature limit for life? We used to think it might be boiling water. 100 degrees Celsius, 212 Fahrenheit. Well, there is now life that definitely lives, even prefers temperatures above that 100 degree mark. If there's elevated pressure, boiling point is not 100 degrees, but it gets elevated very quickly. So the current record holder is an organism that grows at 122 degrees Celsius or 250 Fahrenheit. But we don't know the limit, actually. What about the lower limit to life? Is it zero, like the freezing point of water? Well, again, we know of organisms that are able to live at negative 10 to negative 20 degrees Celsius. How do they do this? Well, if there's salt in the water, then the freezing point is depressed. If they're antifreeze molecules, and organisms have antifreeze molecules in them, it can also, again, live below the normal freezing point of water. There's no known pressure limit to life. The bottom of the ocean's over 11,000 meters, so more than 1,000 times the atmospheric pressure, and organisms are perfectly fine there. The deepest holes we've drilled, we find evidence of life. We have not reached the pressure limits of life. What about acid? Lemon juice is about a million times more acidic than seawater. And there are organisms that can live in acid 1,000 times more acidic than lemon juice. If you remember the pH scale from high school chemistry, college chemistry, there are organisms that can live at negative pHs. The other extreme, something like household bleach is a pH of about 12.5, very alkaline. There are organisms that can live at pHs well above 12.5. What about minimum power requirement? I'm working with a colleague on something. We've determined that the minimum power requirement for a cell might be, this is a great word, a zeptowatt. 10 to the minus 21 watts. Think about your light bulbs at home. 22 orders of magnitude lower power is sufficient for microbial organisms. Radiation gets thrown out a lot, especially in extraterrestrial life. There's an organism known as Deinococcus radiodurans, a bacterium that can withstand 5,000 grays or 5 million rad. About 5 grays can kill a human. This is an organism that can handle 5,000 grays. No sunlight, no problem at all. No oxygen, no problem. No organic matter, no problem. There are organisms that can handle these things. We don't know basically what the limits are. So that brings me to the last point, and that is, what are we actually looking for out there? And that's what I'm going to turn it over to the people to my right. In our own solar system, and Brian will touch on that, we have rovers, landers, orbiters, and lots of high tech from Earth. And we're looking for things like signs of water, certainly, organic carbon, a certain temperature regime, perhaps certain atmospheric gases that Brian may touch on, biomarkers, things that we would find as chemicals, especially, that would suggest this is complex enough to suggest life but not prove it. And perhaps there are fossils, but again, these are not dinosaur footprints we're thinking about, but fossils of microbial cells. So little circles, little blobs, little sticks at a very, very small scale that may or may not indicate life. And then beyond our solar system, we're very much limited to, I believe, to very, very large telescopes. And the search for exoplanets, so planets outside our solar system, is a big target there. And with that, I'll turn it over to Brian, who was actually a graduate student at Washington University when I was an assistant professor there. So we've known each other for a long time. Brian.
Well, thank you very much, Jan. A wonderful introduction, and that's something, as planetary scientists or astrophysicists, we really have to keep in mind. What is life? What do we know about life? And what would we look for elsewhere, even though it may be entirely different? So I've had 15 wonderful years here at University of Colorado. I direct the CU Center for Astrobiology, and I'm part of the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics, and this is a institute of 500 or so engineers and scientists that are building instruments, building spacecraft, designing missions to study anything from our planet, Earth-Sun interactions, climate change, to the surface of Mars or the atmosphere of Mars. So the MAVEN mission is currently in orbit around Mars. That was conceived and mostly built here. To the outer solar system, and the mission that flew by Pluto, we contributed instruments to that as well. So it's a wonderful place to work, and my research is really focused on the most part water at Mars. So Mars right now, cold and dry, very thin atmosphere. So you took a bucket of water, threw it on the surface. Depending where you were and what season, it would either just boil away because the atmospheric pressure is so low, or it'd freeze and then rapidly sublimate. So right now, Mars' surface is kind of harsh, and you know, not a great spot for present life. But in the ancient past, we see all these signs of dried up river valleys. We see deltas. That's when a river flows out into a body of water. So we had standing bodies of water. We've identified 700 or so different lakes across the surface of Mars in the ancient terrains. We've even argued that there are oceans, were oceans on Mars in the distant past. And just back to the river systems and sort of the context why we think Mars might be a good spot to look, many of these are the size of Earth's largest rivers. So we see Amazon, Nile, Mississippi-sized river valleys that were carved on ancient Mars. So it's not like water was at the surface and it was habitable for a brief time. It was at least hundreds of millions of years. So a lot of my work is sort of getting at when the water was there, how long it was there, and what we can learn from the geology to better understand what the climate was like and whether Mars was a habitable environment in the distant past. And then another way we can look at water is through trying to understand the chemistry of those ancient waters at Mars. And we have a lot of chemical precipitates and minerals that are there that tell us something about whether it was really acidic or whether it was really basic or high temperature, or low temperature. And my contributions there, we found a lot of dried up Yellowstones across ancient Mars, so hot spring environments. And these are wonderful places for biology to come about or to thrive even today on Earth. And we think, many of us think, the origin of life on Earth came from a hydrothermal system. So these have been key targets that I study. And the way we go about that is studying the Mars minerals that are there and the chemistries. Then we go to places on Earth that replicate those environments. And that's what leads me to climb into active volcanoes on a yearly basis. And so we're studying really acidic, active, dynamic, high-temperature environments and studying just those hydrothermal processes, but then also the extremophiles that Jan touched on, some of the things that are living there. And we just sequenced an organism that was living at pH 0.2. So this is almost 100 million times more acidic than your tap water, and there's stuff living there. And this volcano erupts every few weeks. So, I mean, in harsh environment, but still there's life there. And that's sort of why we think Mars was habitable and still could be. There's seeps of water coming out even today from the subsurface and implying there's aquifers even today on Mars to a place to look for extant life. But beyond Mars, of course, there are many other possibilities. Europa, large moon of Jupiter, has maybe a 10-kilometer thick water ice crust, and underneath that, we're almost positive there's a salty ocean. And then at the base of that salty ocean, there are likely hydrothermal systems as well. So you have all the ingredients you would need there, a long-lived wet environment, one of these ocean worlds in the outer solar system. Another would be Ganymede, another moon of Jupiter. And you can look at, even out at Saturn, in the Saturn system, the Cassini spacecraft identified geysers shooting off of one of the frozen moons of Saturn, Enceladus. And the spacecraft flew through these and measured the chemistry. So again, salty water at depth underneath the ice shell of some of these moons. And then David Grinspoon, who maybe you came to see and isn't here, you got us instead. Better for worse, he's even talked about life in the sulfuric acid clouds of Venus. So this very hot, harsh, acidic environment might even have life there. So the topic, how are we searching for life? And currently there's the Curiosity rover on the surface of Mars that is detailing lake beds and deltas, this former habitable world, and the chemistry and the minerals that are there, and teaching us a lot about, you know, where the water was and what it was like. But the upcoming missions are the exciting ones. So in 2 years, Mars 2020, a NASA mission, will be another lander and rover that is really the first searching for signs of life mission that we've sent to Mars. So now we know where to look. Now we need to send the missions to look for signs of life. That'll be looking at organics, in particularly for the life question. So organics can form without biology or with biology, but certain ones really seem to only form with biology, so it'll be assessing a wide range of organics on the surface of Mars. And it'll also be caching samples. So we'll be saying, take a piece of this rock and store it. And so it's going to store 10 or a dozen samples that hopefully a future mission will come, land, pick up that cache, and fly it back to Earth. Because we are very limited by rovers and what instruments they can hold in terms of mass, power, and volume. So, you know, we're just scratching the surface at Mars. But if we had those samples back on Earth, we could scrutinize them in any laboratory with any instrument in the world to really get at answering this question. So that's a future direction for Mars research, sample return. And then at the same time Mars 2020 is going, there's a European Space Agency mission called ExoMars. Also looking for organics or microscopic evidence of cells or structures we might interpret as life, along with the chemistry and isotopic analyses that are contained with those. And it actually has a drill that will drill 2 meters down into the surface of Mars and excavate samples from depth. Because at the surface, it's pretty oxidized, pretty harsh radiation environment. But if you get down even tens of centimeters, you get past those problems that you run into right at the surface that degrade DNA or other biological signs. So certainly we have a big upcoming program at Mars. And then beyond Mars, Europa, the moon I mentioned of Jupiter with the big ocean, there's in development the Europa Clipper mission. So that will launch in the early 2020s. It will be in orbiter, go into orbit for about 90 days around the moon Europa. It'll map out how thick the ice shell is. And on top of that ice shell, there are all these strange minerals and probably organics and sulfur compounds sitting there. So it also analyzes sort of what might be coming up and interacting, communicating with the surface environment from the deep-seated ocean. And LASP contributed one of those instruments as well. So that's sort of where we're headed in terms of the upcoming missions. Certainly, we want to look at Enceladus and Titan and Venus and all these other places. Mars is pretty easy to get to, relatively, compared to these outer bodies. So that's been a big focus of our exploration and certainly was habitable through time and I would argue still today. So my prospects of finding life beyond Earth in the next two decades are very high. Certainly there are the environments there and have been through time. Everything we know about life should be able to come about there and be sustained. So I will leave it at that.
So I'm, you know, the 10,000 light year view. That's I think my job. So I don't dive in caves, and I certainly don't go into volcanoes, but I was born and raised in the industrial wastelands of New Jersey. That counts for something and for alien life. So my research group at the University of Rochester, we develop advanced techniques for simulating things like the formation of stars and planets. But it's actually been, I haven't really done astrobiology until recently. And ironically, it was my work with NPR and the New York Times and things that got me sort of turning around to sort of think about life and even civilizations more deeply. So now my group, actually, we're starting to study how exoplanets evaporate when planets are very close to their stars. But what I really want to emphasize to all of you today is that, you know, when it comes to searching for life in the universe, we've entered a new era. This is not your grandfather's SETI. Okay, many of us have these sort of preconceptions when we sort of think about, especially looking for life at distance, not in the solar system, of, you know, astronomers, radio astronomers pointing, you know, giant ears, big radio telescopes, listening for signals of alien civilizations. I'm going to talk a little bit about exo-civilizations, but I want to talk before that about the fact that what has changed dramatically, what has revolutionized deeply, revolutionized our understanding and our approach to life in the universe has been what I like to call the exoplanet revolution. Understand that 2,500 years ago, you can find the Greeks talking about, are there any other planets orbiting other stars? Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake for a number of reasons, but one of the, you know, what contributed to it was his advocating for the fact that other stars had other planets orbiting around them. And it was only 1996 that we discovered, for sure, our first planet orbiting another star. And you know what we know now? That was just, you know, barely 20 years ago. Every star you see in the sky has a planet orbiting it. Every star in the sky. And if you count up five of them, one of them is going to be just in the right place for liquid water to be on the surface. So, you know, one of the most important things we think is water. So what that means is, if you can do this calculation, how many habitable zone planets, how many worlds are there in the universe that are in the right place for life to form? Turns out to be 10 billion trillion, right? That's a lot of opportunities for nature to run the experiment, okay? So what has happened now, what we're going to be doing is over the next 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years, is we're going to be staring at those planets. And the main way we do this is what we call transits. When the planet, if the alignment is right, and the planet passes in front of the star between us and the, so when the planet passes between us and the star, there's a little bit of diminution in the light. The light from the star fades for a second, and we can catch that, and we can actually catch it in detail, because it can last for a few hours. And so we actually are seeing the planet block light from its star. And some of that light, for a short period of time, will actually pass through the atmosphere of the planet, okay? So there's a brief moment there where you actually get light passing through the atmosphere, and when that happens, we can do what is called atmospheric characterization. So we can actually tell what the atmosphere of that planet is made out of. Now, why is that important for life? Well, it was back in the 1960s that James Lovelock, one of the inventors of the Gaia hypothesis, He'd been called to JPL to, you know, design life experiments to look for life. And he was thinking, you know, he's sitting with people who were designing experiments for Mars, and he was like, you know, you guys are all thinking it's Earth-like life. There must be a better way of doing this. And he realized that the atmospheres themselves are life detectors. Earth's atmosphere has been completely changed by the presence of life. And you know that every time you breathe, right? The only reason there's oxygen in the atmosphere on this planet is because of life. If life went away, the oxygen in a relatively brief time would disappear. So what that means is when we're looking at these planets and we're watching the transits happen and we're breaking the light apart to get the spectral signature, we may be able to see things like oxygen and methane, which we believe are going to be biosignatures, right? Now, there's a lot of work that has to go on to thinking about, well, you know, if there's a biosphere, what is the complete range of biosignatures that the atmosphere might hold? So that's an enormously interesting array of work that's going on. But the important thing to understand is people have been arguing about life in the universe for 2,500 years. We are now poised for the first time in all that time to have data. Right? It's one thing to have an argument about something, and you know, you and your friend can yell until the middle of the night about who's right. It's another thing to have data. And over the next few decades, for the first time, we're going to actually have something to argue about, right? Some piece of information about these worlds. So we're going to be staring long and hard at all of these exoworlds, all of these alien planets. And that is a sea change in our understanding, or at least the way we go about this. So there's going to be a lot that we're going to have to figure out. What are the different ways biospheres can work? What are the different ways that biospheres, how they'll change their atmospheres? So that is fascinating and amazing, but even more amazing, I don't want to lose this, right? There's also the possibility that we're going to trip over technosignatures, right? The idea that we have to look with a giant radio telescope for somebody beaming a message at us. It's interesting, but how do we know they want to beam messages to us? Maybe they're all hiding, right? Maybe they don't even use radio waves at all. If we're thinking about exo-civilizations, and that's one thing I want you to come away from this, no more, we're not going to use the word aliens anymore, right? It's exo-civilizations. Because aliens, when you think of aliens, as I've mentioned before, people think about prosthetic foreheads, right? You're like, what kind of antenna do they have on their heads from the Star Trek episode I just saw? And, it's very hard to understand. Who knows what alien biology or exo-civilizations, what they look like? Will they look like reptiles? Will they have eight hands? Whatever. I may not be able to say much about that, but I may be able to say, look, if they've got an industrial civilization and it's a world-girdling civilization like ours, they may leave, artifacts in their atmospheres, right? So it's been proposed perhaps if a civilization is using solar power and mass, that you would see a spectral edge in silica because there's so much so many solar panels. People have already thought about this for biosignatures. People have talked about the red edge, that you can look at some of these planets, and if there's a lot of vegetation, there'll be a spectral signature of all of that vegetation. You can do the same thing for technosignatures as well. And the thing is, we're going to be staring at all of these planets anyway. It would be crazy not to at least be ready to interpret something that we didn't understand in terms of technological civilizations. And this is just so different from anything we've ever done before. So some of you may have heard about the alien megastructure planet. Anybody heard this? It's sometimes called Tabby stars or the WTF star, which means where's the flux? I don't know where you guys' minds are. So. Where's the flux, all right? Get your minds out of the gutter. That was, when that came out, we were all joking about it, but it was actually reasonable to say, look, we see this stuff happening in one of these transits that we don't understand, right? And of course, it turned out to be something else. We think it's, probably dust. But the idea that we'd never consider the possibilities that it has a technological origin, we're past that now. And it's time to stop, as my colleague Jason Wright says, it's time, we got to get past the giggle factor when it comes to exo-civilizations. Because we're already doing exo-biospheres, right? We're looking for exo-biospheres. So this is really a remarkable, remarkable moment in human history that within the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years, we may have evidence of life on other worlds. And, we may even stumble across the possibilities of organized life in the sense of civilizations. So I'll end it there.
Great. Thanks. Thank you, panelists. I want to ask my questions, but I have more than enough questions from the audience. And thank you, students, for submitting those. Please make sure to indicate that you are students so that I can get to your questions first. I need to make sure that you also know, for those of you who have been attending many of the sessions, that CWA is in the position to do some crowdfunding. It's in a crowdfunding campaign. Since we're celebrating the 70th, we are now looking to maybe do something around $70,000 for raising funds for CWA next year and in the future. We're well on the way. At first, the note said at the beginning of the week that we're a quarter of the way, but I was just informed before this session that we're well underway. But support is still needed from everyone. So if there's anything that you would like to contribute, please feel free to hit the donate button on the CWA website. That's for the commercial announcement. All right. I've tried to organize the questions as they've come in, and here's the first one. I'm going to go to Dr. Heinig. How plausible is it that we could someday inhabit another planet? And there's a little footnote here. Heinig, loved your natural disasters course, exclamation.
Well, I love that class, too. And I mean, where else can you just have a whole class where you teach death and destruction by the Earth and meteorites and things like that? So how plausible that we could someday inhabit another planet? I think, you know, certainly within our lifetimes, you have the whole privatization of our space flight industry, Elon Musk and colleagues beyond him that are really pushing the boundaries and, you know, thinking people on Mars in 10, 15 years. So I think first we should start with the moon. That's something we're more familiar with. Things go wrong, you're only 3 days away versus at Mars you're 7 months or a year and a half away from getting back. So start with the moon and colonize the moon to whatever that means before we move on to Mars would be the next easiest target. And you know, my take on The Martian, I enjoyed that movie. I hate almost every Hollywood movie about space and science because there is no science. It's horrible. But The Martian was done really well. That's sort of the current state. I mean, and if we just put the money into it, which is probably $100 billion to have people permanently on Mars, which is, you know, six times NASA's budget annually, then it's not a problem. But, you know, we're explorers. We've always been, and it'll happen in many of our lifetimes, I think.
Thank you. The next question is for Dr. Frank. There are many explanations to Fermi's paradox. In your opinion, what is the most likely solution and why?
That's a good question. I'm actually working on a paper on this right now, so I've been thinking about it a lot. First of all, so Fermi's paradox, for those of you unaware of it, can be phrased a lot of ways. Fermi frames it as, why aren't they here? Why aren't they here? Where is everybody? But it's generally phrased as, look, the paradox is, look, if life and intelligence are common, why don't we see it? And I actually think right now that it's framed, there is no paradox, right? Because how much have we looked? We have this idea of the silent stars. And if you look at how much of the parameter space we've actually looked at in SETI, you know, SETI's never had a lot of funding. NASA's never really funded SETI. So how much have we actually looked in terms of messages from the stars? And Jill Tarter, who's, you know, one of the greats in this field, she says it's basically like taking a thimble and, you know, dipping it in the ocean, looking in the thimble and going, oh, there's no life, right? So we don't know what's out there. There's so many, you know, what wavelength should you be looking at? What kinds of things you should, you know, how long you look? There's just so many things that, in many ways, claiming that there is a paradox is just beyond premature. But if you think about questions about, you know, if we look for a long time, what might the issue be? Well, here's an interesting question, especially if we're just talking about Earth, because that was the original paradox. Why aren't they here? You know, where are they all? And we're just working on a paper now. And if you recognize that, you know, every civilization has a finite lifetime, right? So let's say there were, you know, spaceships that, you know, went through the universe or the galaxy and were colonizing or settling systems. When did they reach us, right? If there was a system that settled, or if there was a civilization that settled Earth 5 or 2 billion years ago, how would we know? Because if they only last 1 million or 2 million years, which is a long time compared to us, there is nothing. I just have a paper that just came out. We just did a paper with Gavin Schmidt, a climate scientist, showing that if there had been another Earth civilization 20 billion years ago, we'd have no artifacts left. The only way we could tell would be looking for weird isotopic anomalies. So if you have a civilization that was 10, 30, 100 million years ago on Earth, if it didn't, if it only lasted for, you know, 1 million years or so, you'd have no record. So I think there's actually, it's quite easy to get around the Fermi paradox. So it's, we're not in any position to say that, you know, the stars are silent.
There was another question related to the Fermi paradox, which I think you've just addressed there, so I'm going to move on. So, student, I'm not ignoring you. I just want to make sure you know that it was related. next. Do you think methane-based life on Titan is possible or likely? And this one is just generally raised. And how much do we know about the TRAPPIST system or other exosystems?
No, I think you should start.
Yeah, that's your kind of your wheel, wheelhouse.
Methane-based life, not exactly sure what you're getting at. Is it life that uses methane as an energy source, or is it life that uses sort of, you know, methane as a solvent, if you will? Certainly methane as an energy source, that we have that on Earth. That is not a problem at all. So methane is a very reduced compound and gets oxidized in a lot. And life on Earth uses electron transfer, so redox chemistry, to power life. Some organisms use methane, some organisms make methane. If it is life in methane, that is a lot. That gets back to sort of how Earth-centric do we think of it, right? So water as our solvent is a very polar molecule. Lots of things dissolve in water. Very different chemistry would happen if methane or a hydrocarbon was the solvent. So it's, then that gets to speculation and fun kind of topics to think about, you know, in a bar over a beer. But it's very difficult to really then relate it to something we know very well. So I'll turn it over to Brian to think more about sort of the amount of methane elsewhere. But it's, again, methane as a starting point for life, absolutely. Methane as a solvent, that's a different story.
And the question was about Titan. This is a large moon of the Saturn system. Has a 1.5 bar nitrogen atmosphere, so more atmospheric pressure than Earth. It's out there, so it's very cold. Your surface is, 70 Kelvin? No. Whatever the conversion is. Zero is absolute zero, right? Nothing is ever colder than that. So you are far, far below where life can be happy on Earth. But, as you head into the subsurface, maybe it warms up. Maybe there's even subsurface oceans at depth. And certainly there are lots of methane, lots of ethane, all sorts of hydrocarbons on that moon. So it actually rains ethane and has rivers and lakes made of ethane and methane, liquid methane, that are sitting on a crust of water ice. So it's a fascinating place and sort of a prebiotic laboratory. We like to consider it, but there are some certain hurdles to having life anywhere at that world, but certainly is considered. Then the other part was, how much do we know about the TRAPPIST system? So I'm going to keep passing.
Briefly, one of the most amazing things about the exoplanet revolution is these solar systems look nothing like ours. We're kind of really an outlier when it comes to the architecture of the solar system, with our nice, tidy arrangement of inner terrestrial worlds and outer gas giants. Do you know what the most common type of world in this the universe is? It's a super-Earth. We don't even have one of those, unless there was Planet 9, right? But so, yeah, a planet that's like, somewhere between 2 and 14 or 10 Earth masses, right? We don't even really know what those things look like, and yet that is the most common type of planet in the universe. So the TRAPPIST system is what we call a compact multi. It's a planetary system usually around a smaller star than the Sun, and the planets are in such tight orbits that you could literally jump from one to the other in a couple of weeks, right? As we talked about, it's going to take months to get to Mars. Mars. But, you know, using Apollo-level technology, you could get from one of these to the other, which means the ability for them to swap spit is pretty amazing. You know, life could have started on one of those worlds, and then quickly, because of impacts, you could have had rocks carrying life onto the other worlds. So we don't really know much. It's a totally new frontier. But think about this. Imagine if all of those worlds were in the habitable zone and you were a civilization that emerged on one of those. You could get to another habitable world, you know, or inhabited world in a week, right? Mars is the best we got, and it's 8 months away, and it probably is going to be difficult to live on right now. But imagine in these these planetary systems, what the possibilities might be.
Thanks. Here's another question that I think really fits with the title of this session. Please talk about current research programs that support this type of new research related to finding places.
Right, so there's the NASA Astrobiology Institute, which is a one program at NASA that focuses on that question of life elsewhere. It has part of it, life on Earth and looking for extreme environments on Earth, but most of that is focused on life elsewhere. That includes exoplanets. There are programs within the NASA Astrobiology Institute that think about exoplanets. There are parts of it that worry about the missions within our solar system. There are theoretical components, experimental components. So that's certainly a very, very big one here. There are other programs, ones that are completely focused on search for exoplanets. And then certainly Europe has gotten big into the game, and Brian has talked about that a little bit. So those are the main research programs here in the U.S. Within NASA thinking about extraterrestrial life. You want to add some?
Yep. Okay, we'll just pass down and move out of the solar system as we go. So, yeah, I mentioned the upcoming Mars astrobiology mission. So these are the true first, you know, we want to look for signs of life. That's a hard thing for NASA to say, because if they don't find it, then does the mission fail and lose public support? But they're pretty certain, you know, Mars had the ingredients and we're going to go for it. We're going to put our cards on the table and start looking for signs of life. Certainly sample return, like I mentioned, would be the ideal way to go about that. And then, moving out to exoplanets, and it's one that's launching in a couple days, 3 days, I think.
Yeah.
TESS.
So TESS is the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. And so unlike Kepler, which just stared at a portion of the sky, the TESS satellite is going to be doing a whole sky survey and looking at the brightest stars, because, you know, the more light you have, the easier it is. So it's going to be a whole sky survey. We're going to learn a lot more about what's out there. JWST, the James Webb Space Telescope, which was supposed to launch next year, and now it's going to launch a little bit later, that is going to have some really amazing capabilities for doing this exoplanet, the atmospheric characterization. And then there's a whole range of missions coming up. You know, people have lots of missions planned. I just want to say, it is just such a tragedy that really there's not more money for this, right? We know, we should be, why don't we have, it's been proposed, robot submarines in the lakes of Titan, right? There's lakes on Titan. I want to know what's on there, right? And we could do this. And, you know, the programs are all so starved that, you know, they have to fight against each other instead of doing all of them. And I just wish, you know, we're at this moment when, you know, thousands of years of human dreams could be realized. And we're just, you know, it's like we're doing these tiny little steps.
And fun fact, half a penny of every dollar of your taxes goes to NASA. So it's small.
Okay, I'm going to butcher one of the words here, students, so I'll apologize in advance. Do experimental files like those found on Earth support the panspermia?
Panspermia,
yes, there we go. Theory.
All right, so panspermia means the sort of seeding of life on Earth from elsewhere. And it is certainly a origin of life theory that gets kicked around a lot. And Adam and I actually talked about it before coming over here. We're both sort of frustrated with panspermia, not in the sense that it couldn't have happened, but it sort of is a little bit, in my view, defeatist in the sense that we don't know how life originated on Earth. So we give up and blame it on some other planet that we can't study as well, and then just assume it came to us. So I think in that sense, it's defeatist as an origin of life theory, because I think we have not yet exhausted the possibilities of how life might have emerged on Earth, when it might have. We don't know when it emerged. We don't know how it emerged. We don't know where it emerged. We don't know how many times it emerged. We don't know whether it emerged on Earth. So then to sort of give up and say, let's blame it on another planet, to me is defeatist. Now, the idea of panspermia, so in other words, transport of life from another planetary body, I think that's very exciting, but to use it as an origin of life theory, I think is always a little bit disappointing.
I'll add a couple comments about Mars. So Mars, smaller planet than Earth and farther from the sun, it probably was habitable before Earth. When we were still in a global magma ocean phase, Mars probably had water flowing on the surface. So if life can come out really quick, maybe it did start on Mars. And how do we get stuff from Mars to Earth? Well, I've been to Antarctica with NASA teams looking at meteorites, and we found 3 rocks from Mars. So an impact at Mars can blast things up into space. Some of that eventually crosses paths with Earth and falls on us. So certainly things get transferred between the planets, and maybe we're all Martians.
I just want to remind people very briefly of, like, what was it, last month we had a visitor in the solar system from another star system. I can never pronounce it, Oumuamua? Sorry, I can't pronounce it, but there was an asteroid that passed through the solar system that came from another star system. So, you know, while I certainly agree as a origin of life theory, panspermia is kind of a bummer. But, you know, just as the idea that, you know, a transport theory, it's very exciting because we now realize, like, wow, there are these rocks from other stars, other star systems that are probably continually passing through the solar system.
Okay, in the last few minutes that we have, I'm going to throw you a curve at the end from one of the questions here. I'm going to combine 2 questions, one from 2 students, I mean 2 audience members. There is always some risk in bringing life from Earth to other locations. What are the limits of this side? And then related, how do you not contaminate other planets or moons with life from Earth when you explore for life? Europa and drilling into the ice to get to the ocean below. They're 2 different angles.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, so NASA has a planetary protection agency and international treaties with many other countries as well. And right there are 2 problems. We send microbes to Mars. It's very hard to clean the instruments to a level where there is nothing, no spores, nothing alive on them. We've tried doing that. The Viking landers that went in the 70s, those were baked at 200 degrees Celsius for, I think, 4 hours or something to try to sterilize them. So forward contamination is a problem. We don't want to go to Mars and look for life, find life from Earth, or seed Mars with Earth life. These are all bad problems. And then also returning these samples, right? This is, you know, what if there is some super virus or whatever that could wipe us out? I mean, I think your odds are extremely low. But any samples that do come back from Mars will, I mean, okay, we already have meteorites from Mars here, and we're all still here. So that's probably why they're so low. But any things returned will be, you know, killed in space and radiated or whatever, and then put in sort of a CDC highest level contamination facility until they're deemed safe before they're shared with the community. Other input?
I just want to say generally about the idea of, you know, settling Mars is this very deep question about, do we have the right to settle Mars, right? Because, you know, as much as, yeah, there's the looking for life as a scientific program, but, you know, do we want to settle Mars? And what does that mean environmentally? I pretty much sort of feel like if, you know, the view is, I'm not so deeply worried about that, just because if we were to create a settlement on Mars, a real human habitation there, we shouldn't think of it as human beings doing it. We should think about it as the Earth's biosphere doing it. You know, our settling of Mars will be Earth's biosphere, you know, reaching its tendril out and finding a new place to, you know, keep the experiment going. So, you know, that's kind of the way I view that other issue.
And I'll just finish with, a couple of years ago I was at a conference and somebody introduced themselves to me and handed me their business card and it said Planetary Protection Officer. That was just the coolest job title in the universe.
So we have only 1 minute left. And gentlemen, how do you turn military funding into funding for astronauts?
I became an American just a couple of years ago. I voted in exactly 1 election, and that didn't go so well. So I think this is a great idea. I have no idea how to make it happen. Certainly, I think one big thing is continued pressure from society asking for support, financial support, resources for science, for education, for healthcare, for all the things that really matter to us. It's just we got to keep pounding on it. And certainly funding for science, including NASA, but other science programs, is vital. It is frustrating, both beyond belief, seeing the cuts in the science funding. Everybody knows that science, that STEM education, that education in general is the absolute most essential things we can do for our the younger generations, and it's getting cut. It is absolutely frustrating.
I have to take it. I'm sorry to do that.
That was good.
This is a very large crowd, and we have to get you out of here. Thank you all very much for coming today.